Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man, Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face Off on WGN Radio. That's right. You're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Emery, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. New year, new laws, and here to once again take a look at the new laws here in Illinois. It's longtime Chicago and Springfield reporter and WTTW correspondent, Amanda Vinicki. Amanda is a repeat guest here on LFO. I'll punch your card. You get two more and you get a free sub.
I'll take it. Anything for free these days.
I mean, we were trying to figure out how many years. It's got to be at least 8 or 9 years, Amanda. So we're so honored to have you again to run down the new laws. Some very serious, always a couple of more interesting ones that we'll keep to the end, but we'll get right into it. You know, there's a whole host of laws that deal with insurance changes. And basically the theme there is, I think, trying to advocate more on the part of consumers to get their carriers to cover more. Just give us a couple of highlights there. And also, is that the trend that you're seeing in Springfield?
Rich, you're exactly on point there in terms of what the objective is, really expanding coverage, mandating coverage. A couple things to keep in mind that you have some of these new laws that are technically in effect for 2025, but really it's more of an opportunity for insurers to prepare to bring into their fold and their coverage some of these mandates. So for consumers, they won't feel the effect of some of these until 2026. There are others, however, that are in place, things that were really mantelpieces of the political framework that Governor J.B. Pritzker threw out last year. So things like curbing so-called junk insurance plans that may seem like you're getting coverage, but then don't actually in effect do much. And you've got like really the number of expansions in terms of insurance coverage run the gambit. There's everything from if somebody has a cancer of the jaw, that mandating that insurers cover jaw surgery versus classifying that as cosmetic. Expanding that you need to have coverage for a mental health or wellness visit, just like you might have an annual physical. There are things like coverage of glucose monitors as part of your diabetes coverage, lowering the cost or capping the cost anyway of EpiPens. So there are a whole lot of them. And one other thing briefly to keep in mind is that people might say, hey, wait a second, my insurance plan doesn't that. A lot of insurance plans are still federally regulated. So Illinois definitely making these changes makes a difference for some families and for the insurers, of course, as well, who will be in some cases paying for it. But it may not apply to every single plan because these are only those sort of smaller plans that Illinois has the power to control.
About on the reproductive health front, especially sort of against the backdrop of what we can expect to see with the Trump administration by way of abortion regulations.
Well, so I think maybe the biggest one that's taking effect this year is that it is a law that folds in reproductive care into the Human Rights Code and says that you cannot discriminate against individuals. So thinking about housing, maybe credit reports, applying for a job based or hiring from somebody for a job based on their reproductive health decisions, be that wanting to expand a family and going into fertility care or a decision to have an abortion, something along those lines. Illinois already has done a lot prior to 2025 that protects access to all forms of reproductive care. I did look back because there is such focus on this. There was a lot of momentum about a year ago on expanding coverage for fertility, things like IVF. Those did not actually pass.
And a couple others, we're going to get into some couple specific ones that are interesting. A couple dealing with schools. There's one that requires schools to provide training for the Heimlich maneuver and CPR and the use of defibrillators. There's also one that requires relaxation activities to students for You know, at first that seems a little silly, but it's only 20 minutes a week. I think that, you know, that sort of speaks to the idea that we're a little more conscious of wellness. And, you know, certainly at student levels, even the idea that this is stressful, you know, and kids might need a little bit of a break from the rigors of their education. What's your take on both of those?
I mean, I have to say that adulting is hard. I much preferred youth, except for having to take tests all the time. And imagine the stress of that, particularly, you know, standardized exams. And you think about in Chicago, even just getting into a high school and how much rigor that takes and stress that puts on kids. I will, however, say this is not a mandate that is. Originally, it had been proposed to require 20 minutes a week of some sort of moment of Zen. That is, in fact, not the case. This gives an option, and it has to be in addition to recess. So if schools do choose to go this route, you would have students getting their playtime, but also potentially they could also legally have 20 minutes a week devoted to, say, yoga, breath work, or meditation.
So you're not skipping algebra to do yoga?
I mean, maybe, but I guess a couple minutes a week, frankly, that would be great by me.
It seems weird to only
about any of that algebra. I mean, God bless my teachers. They were wonderful, but nope.
At first I thought it was 20 minutes a day, 20 minutes a week. I mean, that doesn't just, you're going to do it. Why make it 20 minutes a week?
I'm guessing for the very reason that you talked about, that there would have been pushback in terms of, hey, students have a lot to learn. There have been some dramatic downsides, unfortunately, particularly since the pandemic. But you're right. Certainly, as we just talked about with insurance and sort of mental health coverage, this is trying to see students, I guess, as more of a whole person, and recognizing that if you have a way maybe to calm down, figure out some of that breath work, you would be able to use those techniques going into taking the SAT, ACT, whatever.
The laws actually relates to our very own O'Hare Airport and drivers within a half mile radius. Tell us more about that one.
So I have to say that I, since reporting on this, got sent videos, and wow, the number of cars. It is literally looks like a parking lot when you are near O'Hare, because there are folks who are presumably trying to be kind to their loved ones and be close to pick them up or drop off or whatever. Pickups, I guess. Drop off wouldn't make much sense. But that causes a big headache for all of the rest of us. And now that is something that you could be fined for. It'd be $100 for a violation. And the Illinois Tollway is mandated to have and erect some sort of traffic safety system, is what they're called by law. But basically, you're thinking a camera that will catch violators. And this is anybody who, you know, stops along the shoulder or so of the road within a half mile of the entrances to O'Hare. So don't do it. It is illegal. You could get fined, but also annoying and dangerous.
It really is. And most airports, including O'Hare, has like free cell phone lots, right? The idea is people don't understand what that means. It's so that your loved one or whoever can call you, and you can within, you know, minutes come pick them up. But yeah, people are always hanging out on the side of the road.
Not the place for it. Go to one of those lots.
That's right. There's also, there's a couple dealing with meat. High time that we have our Springfield lawmakers deal with this ever-present problem of meat, Amanda, right?
I think you might be referring to, I don't know, I'm sure, there were about 300 new laws that were passed in 2024, taking effect in 2025. So by the way, that does not include any of the laws that, say, passed in 23 or 22 that took some time to ramp up.
This one is the one dealing with deer meat. Probably.
Yes, deer meat. Okay, yeah. That is the one I'm thinking of. And so what this does, and actually, I mean, in a large part of the state, particularly geographically large part of the state, hunting is a real big deal. And so this has to do with when hunters bring in their meat, and then they either could say, you know, hey, I don't need it. I don't want it. Somebody that is less unfortunate could perhaps use this for their nourishment, or maybe they forget to pick it up. As long as they're a record kept, presumably that is for safety reasons, that could be donated to a charity that shares wild game with those in need. So hunters can decide that when they have a deer. They don't want to bring that meat home on their dinner table. Give it to someone else.
Tina loves deer meat. Just I'm saying that.
I think
you know me. I like my game.
You play the game.
I play the game. Yeah, that's not the kind of game that I'm used to. But be that as it may, one thing I know our listeners would love to hear about is the changes to the Equal Pay Act to round out our highlighting of 2025 laws. Tell us more about that, Amanda.
Illinois has taken steps regarding equal pay in previous years, and then this is a new measure adding on to it. So what happens now is that companies have to list the salary when you are posting a job opening. And the objective is so that people really can know what their worth, in that when you're going in, you're not going to have a company perhaps paying somebody generally that is going to be, according to data, a woman or a person of color less for a job than they would a man. And so this is requiring that companies, again, they have to be larger companies with 50 or more employees, and also they have to post internally. So maybe there is somebody that wasn't sought out to apply for a job, but thinks, hey, I could do that. I'm capable. This is now Illinois law. And again, this sort of adds on to various other laws that Illinois has passed centered on pay equity. You have things like, for example, companies need to turn in data to the state of Illinois so that there's literally somebody whose job it is now to take in that information and monitor it.
Amanda Vinicky, thank you so much for coming on, helping us kick off 2025. It's a tradition like no other.
It is. Well, I don't know about no other, the ball drop and toasting at midnight, but this is a great annual kickoff to the year. So thanks for having me.
It is the grandest of all traditions in media. We'll see you in 1 year.
Till then, hopefully before.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNRadio.com. Well, this is the first LFO of 2025, and we've entered a new public domain year. To talk about that, Jennifer Jenkins is a clinical professor of law teaching intellectual property and director of Duke's Center for the Study of the Public Domain, where she heads its arts project, which analyzes the effects of intellectual property on cultural production. Thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So, Professor, copyright terms on most works in the U.S. are currently 95 years. On January 1st of this year, also known as Public Domain Day, many well-known copyrighted works fell into the public domain. Tell us more about Public Domain Day and about some of the famous works that have been impacted.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So, as you mentioned, we're talking about a 95-year term for these older works. And so works from 1929 went into the public domain just recently this year, January 1st, after the conclusion of the 95-year term. So I guess I'll give you my top four in each category. I was an English major, so I'll start with literature. But we've got Ernest Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms. We've got William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury, Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, and then also we have the first time the Maltese Falcon came out. You've probably seen the movie. But the book was initially serialized in a magazine called Black Mass Magazine. And so all of that's public domain now. With films, we've got a dozen new Mickey Mouse films. Quite cute. He and Minnie continue their flirtation. You've got the first feature film from the Marx Brothers, The Coconuts, which is fantastic. And then you have all these. It was the first year that sound film really came into its own. And so you have all these films that are taking advantage of the capacity for synchronized sounds. And so I'm kind of obsessed with dance sequences. We even put a video up. There's so much dancing from Mickey Mouse to all of these like musical reviews. So that's amazing. Characters, guess what? We got Popeye. This is what everybody's excited about. The first appearance of Popeye's public domain. In the U.S., the first appearance of Tintin, the intrepid globetrotting reporter, and his little dog Snowy, their public domain. Buck Rogers is from 1929. So yeah, he's public domain too. I love Buck Rogers, but actually he's been public domain forever because they didn't renew the copyright in the comic strip. And I'll just mention a few songs and we'll be done with the highlights. And so we got Ain't Misbehavin' by Fats Waller and others. We've got the song Singin' in the Rain, the original version. We've got two great classical pieces. We got Bolero by Ravel and An American in Paris by George Gershwin. So there's just a handful of all the works from 1929 that just became public domain.
And just so everyone's clear, our listeners who might not be experts in this, that what that means is that this IP is now out there and available for anyone to use. It's no longer protected. You don't have to get anyone's permission. We saw this when we covered this last time, that now there was a rash of publications like films made with characters like Winnie the Pooh is now a serial killer, right? There was a movie with Winnie the Pooh as a killer, and all these characters can now be used, an earlier incarnation of Mickey before he was speaking. So that's what that means. You mentioned, Professor, The Sound and the Fury. I found that interesting because that itself was based on a public domain work, Shakespeare's Macbeth. So that's, you know, public domain on public domain. But what's the logic behind this 95-year term? Is that still a reasonable amount of time? Should it be longer? Should it be shorter? I'm sure for the artist protecting the IP, they want it to be in perpetuity. But what's your thoughts on this term?
Part of it depends on the work, right? It's quite a long term. And I did want to mention current terms, not that for people like us, if it's not corporate owned, it's life plus 70. And so that is a key term now for newer work. So like you and I were out there creating stuff. It's the day that we kick off plus 7 years. That's how long our works are going to last. But if you're making a work made for hire, owned by a corporation, it's still the 95-year term. The logic behind it is actually constitutionally enshrined. The Constitution says, quote, that copyrights must last for limited times. And so why? Because if you sit back and look at the vast majority of works, they're not still making any money after 95 years, after 75 years, right? And so for all of those, no one's actually benefiting from the continued copyright term. And so one of the things is, you know, it's wonderful that works that are still famous, like the ones we're talking about, that at least someone's benefiting from the copyright term. But for all of the other ones that aren't even sort of out there in circulation anymore, when they go into the public domain, anyone can share them and use them. And a lot of them are completely forgotten by that time because no one can share them and put them out there and make them available in databases. And so, yes, for, you know, if I happen to be one of those superstars and I actually created a work that stands the test of time and after 95 years, anyone wants to pay to see it, that was great. But that's not the way the copyright term functions. The 95 years is not just for that subset of works. It's for everything. So think of all the stuff from 1929 where no one's benefiting. And now that these works are out there, people can find them, can do something with them, can adapt them, you know, make an adaptation for your high school orchestra, whatever. And so the logic behind copyright terms expiring is that after a limited period of time, they go into the public domain where they can feed future creativity. And, you know, as a creator, you guys probably create things. I create things. We're straddling both sides. We're both owners, but we're users too. It's hard to create without building on other IP. And so once stuff's in the public domain, we can all sort of use it and create from it, and we can have a better chance of having access to it. That's the key thing.
Professor, when we discussed this topic last time, as Rich mentioned, mm-hmm. one of the things that we took a look at was, and sort of to your point, it isn't as if copyright is the only avenue to protect some of what I would say is the more valuable aspects of a brand that might be created around certain copyrighted works, like taking Mickey Mouse, for example. What are some other avenues for legal protection that exist beyond just having an enforceable copyright in a particular work?
Sure. So if you take some of the blockbuster works like or characters like Mickey Mouse or, you know, Winnie the Pooh or even Popeye that are still generating money after 95 years, there's two things. One is these famous characters actually, you know, keep reappearing in copyrighted works over time. And so a lot of these characters appeared, their initial iteration is public domain, but the later iterations of those characters may have copyrightable features, copyright eligible features that are in works that are still under copyright. So there's still that. Like, so talking about Mickey Mouse last year, you know, when I think of Mickey Mouse, the first time he really like came onto like my scene in my brain when I was a kid was watching Fantasia. Well, Fantasia Mickey is still copyrighted. And then you mentioned other avenues to the extent that characters in particular function simultaneously as a brand. And that's rare. Most characters you think about, Alice in Wonderland is not a brand. Santa Claus is not a brand, right? But with something like Mickey or Winnie, they may actually function as a brand signifier, just like a logo on merchandise. And if they do, they're still being used for that. They might still have trademark rights. Those are more limited than copyrights, but by and large, it's not time. You know, if they function as a brand, you can't put the image of that character on the same merchandise, goods and services, products that they serve as a source identifier on. But you can still use the initial iteration in new creative works so long as your use doesn't mislead, confuse, deceive consumers into thinking that your new creative work is sponsored or endorsed by the brand owner. So those are the two avenues for really famous, primarily characters that have entered the public domain.
That's our last question. Back in 98, the Sonny Bono copyright, pardon me, the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act extended the term by 20 years for all existing copyrights at that time. Has there been other legislation proposed to further expand these terms or anything else dealing with this issue in terms of legislation or other efforts?
Not any prominent attempts, and I think there are many reasons for that. When the 1998 term extension, part of what we were doing is we were harmonizing our term with terms around the world, and so you know, in that sense, Europe already had a life plus 70 term, and so we moved our term for people from life plus 50 to life plus 70. That justification or impetus for extending the term is entirely absent now, because now we are harmonized with the European Union and a lot of other countries, and so if we added another 20 years, we'd be out of sync with everybody else. And also there are benefits to like a small, tiny subset of blockbuster works for longer terms, but it doesn't do any good for everybody else. And so the harms from term extension have now been very sort of well documented. And even the former head of the Copyright Office, when she wrote something called the Next Great Copyright Act, and her proposal, which isn't crazy, was that if you have a blockbuster work, sure, you get the whole term, you get to opt into it. But for everything else, that they would go into the public domain earlier, because no one's benefiting from continued copyright, which is kind of logical if you think about it. And so the proposals that have actually come out from some of the, you know, the copyright people in the U.S. government have actually gone the other way, which is sort of pushing back a little bit on the blanket long term for everything.
I just looked at the Popeye, the original Popeye logo, and it's a little different than the Popeye that I think we're all used to. So I don't know how.
You know, he's got the big forearms.
Yeah,
but he's got no biceps, which kind of like I'm like, where are the biceps? And he's got the tattoo. He's got the outfit. He's got the pipe. You know, he's got the getup. And his personality's the same. Yeah.
Before he realized the weight gaining legacy of spinach eating.
There you go.
Yeah, it took him a couple years to. He started out by rubbing the head of this Whiffle hen named Bernice, which is so wonderfully random. And so that's, I mean, like, who knew?
Well, it is a superfood. We all learned that because of Popeye. Professor Jennifer Jenkins, thanks so much for coming on with us today.
Hey, it's great talking to you. Everyone, stay safe out there and have a great new year.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Bartini. I'm Brian Burrow. As we await the Luigi Mangione murder trial, his good looks could play a factor. David Bernard is director of jury consulting at Magna Legal Services. He's done extensive research in the area of jury decision-making. David, thanks so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Happy to be here.
So, you know, I'm reading, Doctor, from a poll that I see nearly half of college students in America view the accused murder of the CEO favorably, and more than 8 in 10 hold a negative opinion of the CEO that was murdered, allegedly, on the streets of New York. Much, of course, has been made of the accused assailant's appearance, right? We've seen endless amounts of photos of him, many shirtless. He, you know, is perceived as being in very good shape and a good looking guy. You're an expert in jury consulting and how jurors perceive not just the facts of a case, but the appearance of those who appear before a jury. So how much do you think the appearance of Mangione will affect jurors?
Well, first of all, I just have to say we should take a step back and look at where jurors are coming from, because jurors sometimes get a bad rap. But really, after talking to thousands of real jurors after trial or mock jurors, one thing I can tell you is that across the board, they want to do a good job. They want to find the truth and they want to reach a just outcome. And they want to do their job right, even though they're a little bit uncertain of how to do that. But they are taking in a lot of information. Some of that is referred to as central information that they're coming in, but some of it's peripheral. And the appearance of the defendant is one of those peripheral aspects that can have an impact, even if jurors are not aware that it is actually impacting their decision. So there is a term which is referred to as the halo effect in the psychological literature. And what that means is that when you are aware of one positive trait about somebody, you're more likely to assume other positive traits. Attractiveness is one of those positive traits. So if you see someone as physically attractive, not knowing anything else about them, you're more likely to believe that they have integrity, that they're credible, that they're being genuine, all those factors. Now, we also see that even actually in the courtroom, and that is referred to as the attractive defendant effect, appropriately named, is that defendants who are more attractive have been observed, and the data backs this up, that they tend to get either potentially more lenient sentences. Jurors tend to be a little more sympathetic. They are viewed as more moral, more credible, which aligns very much with what we see in the media. You know, the hero is usually is attractive, and the villain is the monster. So that can have an effect. And so it is likely that his boyish good looks could have an impact on the way jurors view him as. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be discounting certain facts or evidence, but it could impact how they shade the information.
Doctor, I was actually just going to ask you that because, you know, knowing that the halo effect exists, as well as against the backdrop that the vast majority of jurors want to do a good job, would they actually take the additional step of potentially ignoring evidence, such as a video purporting to show the crime, either ignore it consciously or subconsciously just because the defendant is attractive?
So they're most likely not going to directly ignore the video, but what it does is it shades either how they view it or the level of weight that they give it. And it could also, it depends on the narrative that the defendants are presenting and the narrative the prosecution's presenting and then the counter narrative that the defendants are presenting. And if they, for example, try to cast some doubt about the validity of the video, that may, once again, that could make a little bit of a difference if whether or not they believe that this is somebody who is capable of committing such a crime. Now, obviously, there is also other evidence other than just the video. But as far as interpreting the story, jurors, if they see an attractive defendant compared to a less attractive counterpart, they want to believe good things about that person. Now, once again, that just those inclinations aren't necessarily mean they're going to discount evidence that is very compelling.
So jurors like good-looking people, is the opposite true, that less attractive people do worse? And we've seen, you know, it's common every time a litigant is in court, you know, you see them perhaps beforehand and they're disheveled and they're not wearing a shirt. Suddenly in court, you know, they're dressed very well, they're dressed up, but you can't change the way someone looks. So do less attractive people do worse?
So the answer is yes. The answer, there's even an opposite effect to the halo effect, and it's sometimes either called the horn effect or the devil effect, where it is that less attractive people, and once again, attractiveness is somewhat subjective, but there are conventional standards. And so somebody who's conventionally less attractive, and this can be even the way they present themselves, the way they talk, the way they carry themselves, their expression, all of that can contribute to attractiveness. But they tend to receive harsher punishments. Their view, as I said, in the media, this is supported, that we tend to see the villain in movies tends to be the monster, tends to be the one with the scowl on their face and looks ugly. So same thing happens in the courtroom. That aligns with jurors' expectations.
So, Doctor, how much do you think Mangione, who seems to be a pretty smart guy, he's Ivy League educated, how much do you think he's aware of this phenomenon and leveraging it to his advantage?
That's interesting. So I'm sure him and his trial team are aware, given the level of media attention that his looks have received, they are likely, but how they leverage it is going to be interesting. Because there is, like I said, the halo effect, but there's a caveat to it. And there's a caveat even to the attractive defendant effect, that if a jury believes he is attempting to leverage his good looks, or generally, if jurors believe, if a defendant is, let's say, accused of fraud or utilizing their good looks or their sway or their charisma to influence others, that can have the opposite effect, where jurors are more likely, that conforms to their narrative that, yeah, this would make sense that somebody looks like that is trying to utilize and take advantage of that. So they'll have to be very careful with the way that they approach his defense at trial, because while they will want to humanize him and want jurors to see the sympathetic side to him, if he comes across as being manipulative, and it's going to be his demeanor in the courtroom, even sitting at counsel table, up on the stand, if he's throwing casual little glances to the jurors, they're probably not going to like that, and that could come back to bite him.
Yeah, I mean, listen, plenty of good-looking guys on death row, all right? I mean, Ted Bundy was perceived to be really good-looking. We know what happened to him. I mean, the Menendez brothers, people, you know, were going gaga over before there was, you know, the internet, really. Scott Peterson, you know, those are some high-profile examples of people who were perceived as very good-looking that didn't seem to change the fact that they were found guilty. So to your point, it's not the only factor. And if they overplay it, if a jury is seen as, you know, they're trying to use it to avoid liability, then that could obviously have a backfiring effect. So, you know, I want to just get your opinion on what we talked about, these polls. I mean, I've never seen anything quite like this, and perhaps it's a feature of where we are in terms of social media. But I've never seen a defendant, especially one that, listen, we have to use the word purportedly as lawyer, but we saw this guy shoot the CEO dead on the streets of New York. Especially one with, you know, such a black and white case, seemingly never seen this type of reaction of someone supporting him, right? That's obviously largely, or in some ways, a result of people feeling wronged by insurance companies and the healthcare system. We get all that. But what's your take on this public reaction to him? And besides his appearance, how do these TikTok videos and memes and the explosion of support for him on social media, how might that affect getting 12 people in a box who are going to judge this case based on its evidence? Well, I know that's a really long question. I'm sorry, but...
No, not at all. No, that's good. It's a lot too there. I would say, one, jury selection is going to be very important. But going back to even what you're saying about this explosion that we've seen in this reaction, which I agree with you, seems very counterintuitive when there is a real person who was murdered here. But what it is it's a manifestation of what we see across the country in mock trials all the time, is that jurors have a big problem with, or at least I should say the community has a big problem with, large corporations and insurance companies. And when they have an opportunity to either send a message or take action, they will do so. Now, Twitter and TikTok are not the jury box. They are not the same. But that being said, those sentiments that we do see expressed on social media, they can find their way. And those narratives, of, for example, the narrative that has been pushed out on TikTok, that this is a story where there's multiple sides to it, where there is an industry that motivated such conduct, and that this was somewhat of a lashing out. That narrative, that there is more to this than just a cold-blooded murder, that could find its way into the jury box. And so that's why jury selection is going to be very important, that both sides are going to want to highly vet jurors. The prosecution is going to want to suss out those jurors that have negative views of, you know, insurance companies, corporations, that, once again, they're not necessarily just going to let him get away with murder, but they might be more lenient. They might be more willing to accept some alternative version then this was just completely egregious conduct.
We have a couple of minutes. I want to ask you just a follow-up. And in many ways, you know, I know you work with clients and you really use social media. In many ways, you know, the amount of social media attention on this and people who have come out makes it easier to vet out, right? There's probably more people, potential jurors, who have commented on this case than your average case. So in that respect, you can really weed out people who are, you know, pro-defendant in this case. But, you know, you're a PhD. You mentioned something that was really interesting. You know, what's the difference between people who are likely to act out on social media in support of someone like Mangione and those that are willing in a jury box to let someone free? Those are two very different things, right? You might be very pro, you know, Mangione, anti-CEO when you're, you know, a keyboard warrior, but it's very different to go into a jury box and, you know, send someone home who otherwise might face the electric chair, right? Talk to us about the difference there.
I agree with you. There is a difference. However, you do not want any of those keyboard warriors on your jury, or at least the prosecution's not. So yes, I do think there is a difference. And there is even a difference of the general sentiment. You know, the loudest voices are the ones that are going to be on their keyboards, that are going to be speaking up. But in the jury box, you're going to get less opinionated people. That being said, the best indication of those people's views often can be what have they posted online? What have they liked? What have they commented on? What views, even if they are not going to be those jurors that are those people that are screaming on Twitter and TikTok, did they like them? Do they somewhat align with that perspective? And that's going to be valuable information for both sides to know when they're picking their jury.
Well, we likely won't see Luigi Mangione in court again until next month. So we'll see what 2 months in custody does as far as changing his look to the public. David Bernard, thank you so much for coming on with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Supreme Court Justice Sam Alito confirmed that he spoke with President-elect Donald Trump the day before Trump urged SCOTUS to halt his January 10th sentencing in New York in that hush money case. Return guest Gabe Roth, executive director with Fix the Court, is here to talk about it. Thanks for joining us, Gabe.
Thanks for having me.
Amazing stuff, Gabe. Thanks for coming back. You're a frequent guest. We really appreciate it. You're an expert in this. You appear all over the media on these issues, so we're really humbled to have you on the show again. Trump is scheduled to be sentenced tomorrow unless the Supreme Court stops that. It doesn't look like it's being stopped. So it's important that the Supreme Court not speak with incoming presidents, especially ones that are litigants in these kind of cases. Explain to us what the problem is. Well, first of all, tell us what Alito has said about this phone call. He's, of course, denying that it had anything to do with this issue or one of the many issues he might rule on when Trump is president. He says it was about a law clerk, a reference. Talk to us about that answer, and then we'll get your thoughts on how what the problem could be here.
Well, to your point, Rich, it is very strange. The law clerk in question, yes, was an Alito law clerk, but that wasn't his only job, right? He worked for Senator Mike Lee and was his chief counsel, actually was the chief counsel before Phil Alito. Sam's son was Mike Lee's chief counsel. He also worked for DOJ and at a time when Bill Barr was the attorney general. And of course, Bill Barr and Donald Trump were on the outs. But at the same time, he could have found other folks at DOJ or even other folks at the Supreme Court to vouch for him if needed, which, you know, doesn't seem like is something that Will Levi needs. That being said, you know, the conversation is, from my perspective, clearly unethical with, as you mentioned, the fact that Justice Alito is one of the nine people who's going to determine so much of what moves forward during the Trump administration. You can imagine any number of issues on immigration, healthcare policy, energy policy, abortion policy, ending up at the Supreme Court, and having a call between Donald Trump, the incoming president, and Sam Alito is incredibly unseemly and should be fairly obvious to anyone out there that it is that.
So look, we've covered extensively in our show. You're one of the leading experts on the issue of the need for rules for Supreme Court justices receiving gifts, acting in a certain way, speaking in a certain way. Alito is the leading recipient of gifts by far, with Clarence Thomas being second. Again, you've been on our show covering what the problems are and how there should be reforms. Does this conversation sort of underline this idea that Alito seems to have, as do many others, some who have been appointed by Democrats, that the Supreme Court is above the law, that they don't have to subject themselves to the same laws and rules that everyone else has to, particularly ones that are on the federal bench who have extensive rules? Does this, in your opinion, underline the mindset that Alito has that, hey, I'm on the Supreme Court, I can pretty much do what I want?
I think that's exactly what it does. What we have here is a justice that, as you pointed out, has accepted an extensive number of gifts, many of which he hasn't reported. He has spoken to members and we think potentially even leaked certain things to members of the Wall Street Journal editorial board. He has a very cozy relationship there. He has said that Congress can't make laws that impact our institutional functions, which, besides the fact that it's untrue, the fact that he said that is effectively, you know, an example, number one, of why he thinks that he is above the laws that Congress makes. And of course, you know, look, when it comes down to brass tacks, the only way really to hold a justice accountable is impeachment and removal, and that's not going to happen. I mean, I think there are some creative ways to do it beyond some of the Senator Whitehouse, Congressman Nadler and Johnson enforceable ethics bill. I mean, I think you can play with the justices' discretionary budget of $150 million. You can't change their salaries under the Constitution, but you can stop funding their law clerks, which is something I'd like to see, frankly. But in the larger sense, the Supreme Court should be setting the tone of ethical stewardship in the country, and they're not. And anybody who's a 1L or has spent any time with the ABA knows that ex parte communications is not kosher, and that's exactly what you have here.
Not only should they, but don't they have to, based on this new rule that's only a year old that John Roberts put in place that prohibits justice from acting in a way that has the appearance of impropriety? To your point, 1L, which should know that. I'm in court all the time. I was in court this week, 2 days ago, on a motion before a circuit court of Cook County judge. And, you know, I can only imagine if my opposing counsel heard the judge say to me before we started this motion, hey, it was good talking to you last week on the phone. We didn't talk about this case, but we talked about other stuff. I mean, what would happen? Opposing counsel would go nuts as they rightfully should, as I would go nuts.
Absolutely.
But yet the highest court in the land and the highest litigant in history are allowed to have a phone call. It's and just to the point, doesn't it just violate this new rule that's only been in place for a year?
So that rule is self-policing. I mean, it's only as good as the sheet of paper that it's being written on, and it's, which is shown to be not very good. If it's only the justices who are saying whether or not their behavior is ethical, then we're just going to have these, you know, nine paper saints who rule and lord above us, as is the case. You know, until you have congressional action, budgetary action, significant changes to the personnel of the court, some emphasis from the Chief Justice to sort of lay down the law, an actual internal ethics office, an inspector general, other things that other branches and other parts of the judiciary have that the Supreme Court doesn't, this thing is going to continue to happen. And my main concern, too, is that, you know, in this era of Trump and Alito and Thomas, you know, there are 2,300 other federal judges. If this is the sort of line of thinking or line of behavior that they're leading with, then that, I feel, has some real downstream effects and will tell a judge in the Seventh District in the Loop, or, you know, Northern District of Illinois in the same building, or somewhere out in, you know, another county, in, you know, here in Fairfax, Virginia, where I'm at, that judicial ethics doesn't matter. And I think that that's a really sad place, but we're definitely getting there.
Gabriel, we're watching, but what's going to happen with our last question? What's going to happen with sentencing tomorrow? Is it proceeding?
Oh, that's a tough call. I feel like this is going to be one of these, you know, the Supreme Court is dashing off opinions. Maybe that's why Gorsuch and Thomas were not at the Jimmy Carter funeral. You know, I think that they're two of the three most likely to dissent from something that that comes down if it's, you know, a majority of, or an intermingling, let's say, of conservative and liberal justices. They're the two of the three most likely to dissent. But Alito was at the funeral this morning. I don't know. I think that, you know, every time I try to make a prediction about the outcome of a Supreme Court case, say maybe Dobbs, I miss a justice or two. So I'm not going to make a prediction on this one. But I would expect something to come down pretty late.
Guys, how many memes are we going to see of Trump talking to Obama? What they were so engaged in discussing? It was mostly Trump speaking, Obama nodding, but he was the only ex-president to give Trump even the time of day.
That seating chart. I mean, I've you know, I give props to whoever did that, because, you know, Obama's probably one of the only people in the world who's, you know, could sort of just listen and pal around and hang out and be okay with it. And just, you know, if Michelle was there, though, I don't know if he would have done the same thing. So, you know, I mean, I think it was the lack of Michelle that seeing no conversational companion, he just went straight to the person next to him. And that was Trump.
Noticeable absence. She, by the way, had a scheduling conflict. We heard from her people was in Hawaii. That'll do it. So Trump sentencing still scheduled for tomorrow in New York. Gabe Roth, thanks so much for coming on Legal Face Off with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Legal Face Off on WGN. It's time for the Legal Grab Bag, first one of 2025. We're joined by Kevin Swarren, partner in practice, leader of property and casualty at USI Insurance Services in beautiful Seattle, Washington. We haven't had a lot of Seattle representation here on LFO. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for having me, Ryan.
And representing Minnesota, Adam Bungie, a coverage attorney with Ideal 3. And not only is he someone who's handled more than 10,000 claims, but he is the floor model of Ideal3.com. I don't know if you've been to the website. I saw you front and center there, Adam, on the website. Congratulations. Thanks a lot for jumping on with us.
Thanks.
I think you might be under—
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be described as a floor or model. Both of those things.
I think you might be under-titling him. You might be underdoing his title a little. The CEO, the C-E-damn-O of Ideal3.
C-E-damn-O. All right. There we go. All right, Rich, President-elect Trump watch for another 11 days, and then we flip to President Trump watch. How do you want to kick off the 2025 grab bag?
Did anyone watch the Carter funeral? The most interesting part was, you know, anytime you see the presidents and the ex-presidents together, it's fascinating. So Trump was on the end. He was chatting up Obama, you know, the entire time, a little too animatedly, but he got snubbed by Bush. Now, you don't know what happened behind the scenes, of course, but in front of the cameras, Bush walked right by him. Biden walked right by him. Trump did go say hi to Pence, who, of course, you know, he was in favor of hanging not that long ago. But that was interesting. But yeah, the Trump watch news legally is that the sentencing is tomorrow in the New York case, still going on. He asked the appellate court in New York. So Marchand, remember that the trial judge said that the trial is going to be sentenced tomorrow. Now, by all indication, he's not going to be sentenced to jail. Marchand said he's aware of the fact that he's going to be president. It's not practical. Trump's attorneys appealed that. The New York appellate court denied that and said the appeal should, or the sentencing should proceed tomorrow. Trump appealed to the Supreme Court. We haven't heard as of this minute whether they're going to stop the sentencing tomorrow. Interestingly, it was just uncovered by the New York Times, Tina, that Trump had a call with none other than Samuel Alito this week, who happens to be one of the nine people who will decide this crucial issue. Now, Alito says it wasn't about this incredibly important decision that he's about to make. It was about a job reference. And, this issue didn't come up in this phone call that Alito had with the president-elect. But we'll see. I mean, I think by all accounts, it will proceed tomorrow. He will not be sentenced to jail, obviously. But importantly, if he's sentenced, he will be a felon going into the White House.
Yeah, Rich, I just think that like a lot of these other stories we've covered, it's probably going to end up in one big yawn. Maybe he'll be fined $500. He'll pay it. And then, he'll go through his inauguration on the 20th. I just don't think that this is going to amount to much of anything.
I mean, Adam, there is some substance. And to be fair to Trump, no matter how you think, I mean, legally, we try to focus on some legal issues. Legally, there's a lot to the appeal, because the Supreme Court ruled that certain actions of the president, are okay. And he's arguing that a lot of what he was discussing that led to the conviction do fall under the Supreme Court decision. So to be fair, like Marchand gave them a really short period of time to get this appeal worked out. We know from practicing law that appeals take months, months and months to get together. So to be fair, it was a short period of time.
Well, I think that was intentional.
For sure.
Rich, I think he wants to get a case with him. There's no doubt that he wants to do that. And I'm just marveling at the fact, because, I'm a former Illinois resident myself. Usually you do this after someone serves as executive, right? We've done this with governors going back time immemorial with Ryan and Blagojevich. They need to be better about checking with us in the second city about how we do things.
Right. Yeah, that's true. We have a long history. We'll be covering one of those stories in a moment. Kevin, what are your thoughts on... is this going to go away tomorrow, basically, and be a footnote to history?
I think people prove by how they voted, they're tired of some of this nonsense. And, I think it goes away. I think it's certainly news. But, as a layman, legal layman, there's so much of the judiciary system that has become political and people are tired of that part of it. Let it sit on its side of being political.
And be done with it and finally get to what the American people wanted when they elected Trump, which is purchasing or acquiring Greenland by force.
Trump said, and the Panama Canal.
And Canada. And Canada.
Let's get to the real reason Trump was elected.
Trump sentencing still on, by the way, as of last check for tomorrow. So, wild story out of Las Vegas. Not only did a Cybertruck explode outside of the Trump Hotel in Vegas on New Year's Day, but Tina, AI may have been involved.
And so since the explosion, there were a lot of questions initially. We've learned since the explosion that Matthew Allen Livelsberger was the person who was behind it. He was openly critical of the U.S. government and appeared to acknowledge that he blew up the vehicle on purpose. He not only allegedly used AI, but he was actually through phone apps. He was pretty critical of the U.S. government, had two letters, one of which said specifically it was not a terrorist attack. The other was, just being critical of the U.S. government generally. He also issued a manifesto through this app saying that he was pretty critical of the current administration and that his military experiences have haunted him so much that he essentially had nothing to live for, which was apparently to try to justify why he decided to do this. On the AI front, there appear to be indications that he obtained information on several aspects of his attack, including how to put together an explosive and how to set off the explosion. Rich, we've talked about AI in the past on this show, and especially ways in which it can be leveraged both positively as well as negatively. At least it looks like here, the material, at least based on what we've been seeing here, most of it, if not all of it, was already publicly available. And when he called up the information, apparently there was a warning that this information related to activity that is dangerous. I mean, Rich, I personally think we have to be really careful here about blaming AI for this type of thing. I mean, we may as well blame the internet for making information, you know, easily accessible in ways that weren't pre-internet. And we've got this app here that he was issuing manifestos on and letters that seem to indicate he was pretty troubled. And, you know, I think, you know, if we go down this path, it's a pretty dangerous path to go down. It's a slippery slope here.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting story to think this is the first AI-driven terrorist attack or crime. But really, what to your point, what's the difference between asking AI how to build a bomb in a Cybertruck versus Googling it, right? Which is something that's been around for 20 years. Same thing, just a little more probably presumably fast and maybe quicker to do it by AI. Second point, Kevin, I think, is that the question is what, if any, you know, good point raised by Tina. What, if any, liability do AI providers, there is such a thing, have? And the authorities, the cops have said they have not yet received, you know, cooperation from, you know, ChatGPT, which is what he used. They don't know if the capability exists for someone to track that. Again, it's a can of worms if you're going to start tracking how people use AI. I mean, AI is already incredibly prevalent. It will be even more in the next few years. To what extent does the, you know, ChatGPT in this case have either criminal or civil liability?
I mean, in terms of liability, I don't think much at all. But could they get dragged into lawsuits and things? For sure. I mean, that will they be named? Possibly, because that's where money can come from. But the unfortunate part, to Tina's point, is there's no difference other than the fact that the information is there and that it's just more easily readily available to the folks that are. You're never going to change the fact that there are bad actors or bad people or people that have and or are dealing with mental health issues. And then there is going to be bad situations that come from it. So ultimately, you have to look at the underlying. Why are they in this position? Why are they feeling this way? Why do they do the things that they're doing? It's not ChatGPT. It's not the internet. It's that he had mental health issues, most likely. And where did those come from? Well, how are we supporting our veterans? Let's go all the way back and say, did this man get the needs and services that were needed for him to deal with his challenges? And that's kind of where my head would go. But, you know, will ChatGPT be liable? No, I don't think so. I hope not.
Well, let's pick up with that, Adam, on that. Adam, so why should it, if this technology is as smart as we know it is, and it's as advanced as we know it is, and we're letting, you know, AI drive vehicles and replace humans, why shouldn't they also be, you know, burdened with the responsibility legally to warn authorities when they're receiving information like this that presumably was identifiable as a threat?
That's the exact thing where my mind went, Rich, is obviously, this information was collected. Why wasn't it shared as it would have been had, you know, he told his therapist or something that he was going to hurt people? They would have had a duty to warn. That's one of the exceptions that they have. So why would a machine that doesn't have any feeling not be a narc? This is something that it should be doing. It when there's danger like this, if it's that smart, it should be letting authorities know, hey, there's a potential threat here. I don't know that there's real privacy concerns that override the safety concern there of, you know, who's doing in their spare time searches on how to blow up Teslas in front of Trump Tower.
Yeah. Right. I mean, if AI could.
What is the overriding privacy concern that we should be protecting there?
Yeah. I mean, if AI could put together a legal pleading, it should be able to identify a manifesto.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah. All right. So from Las Vegas to Chicago, former Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan took a gamble at his racketeering federal trial, actually testified in his own defense. Rich, was that a surprise to you?
I mean, we try not to be too local here, even though this is our state. But this is a national story. Why, Tina? Because Michael Madigan, widely known as the longest serving speaker of any house in American history, you know, served here forever and was the kingpin in Illinois politics, now standing trial in a federal corruption trial and took the stand. The news is this trial has been going on for weeks and kind of surprisingly, given the timing of it, just took the stand the other day this week. And I guess the question is, we'll see how that is perceived. He started off by talking about his family and how he had a rough upbringing. His father didn't pay attention to him, blah, blah. You know, like, from anyone who doesn't buy that kind of thing as an excuse to steal money from taxpayers, it's not going to be well received. But what's your thoughts on him testifying? Of course, the conventional wisdom generally in criminal cases is that you don't testify. You're only going to do harm to your case by testifying. You don't have a duty, of course, to testify. And most criminal attorneys will tell you, you know, shut up and make the prosecution prove their case. So what are your thoughts on Madigan testifying in this case?
Yes, Rich, is that they made a very strategic and careful calculation along the lines of what you just described, knowing what the general issues are with people testifying in a criminal trial on their own behalf. There are definitely issues, but he's pretty sophisticated, and I'm sure they did the cost-benefit analysis, and I'm sure he was very well prepared. And so on balance, I think there was a story and a narrative he wanted to get out there, and it's probably most compelling for it to come from him. And so I think that was probably the reasoning behind it. And I think he got out there what he wanted to get out there in terms of his side of the story.
Yeah, Kevin, perhaps that conventional wisdom that you don't testify goes out the window with such a high profile defendant, right? I mean, it's almost if you're in the jury box and you're, you know, you don't hear from this person, by the way, who rarely would speak. He's one of these people who, you know, all of his moves would go on behind the scenes. Not many Illinoisans have ever heard him speak. So if you're in the jury box, you're thinking, well, he probably has something to hide. I want to hear him speak. And, you know, that's probably why he's making this move.
Well, and there's got to be some ego to it, too, that says, hey, if I'm going to defend, if anyone's going to defend my case, it's got to be me, you know, and yeah, I think a tactful move, Rich, to say, hey, I don't speak that much. I'm going to come and bring the sort of emotional, passionate plea to it. But it sounds like he put McClain under the bus and that doesn't go over very well with the jury either. So I don't know if it more harm than good, but it sounds like he analyzed it himself.
Brian, you're obviously covering the story, probably the talk of the newsroom in some respect. What's the take of the media? I mean, probably not that surprising that he testified, right?
It's tough for us because there are no microphones that are allowed in there. So we're just kind of getting play by play from the people who have been inside covering it for the last 2 weeks. They're on break for the next 2 days. So we're going to pick it back up again next week and we'll see where it goes. But this thing was supposed to be over in December, and here we are in mid-January now, and it's still rolling along. All right, let's move out to Hollywood. We've got some actor beef. Well, actor-director Justin Baldoni is suing actress Blake Lively. Tina, these two co-stars do not like each other.
And the story started, as you know, before Justin Baldoni sued Blake Lively. She first sued him for sexual harassment last month, arising from things that arose during the movie filming It Ends With Us, in which they both co-starred. She claims he orchestrated a smear campaign against her after she complained about what she characterized as on-set misconduct. He subsequently sued the New York Times on New Year's Eve, claiming that the newspaper engaged in libel and false light invasion of privacy. He claims that they helped create a false narrative that was very pro Blake Lively and cherry picked out of context certain communications, a lot of texts between the two actors. He said she's indulging and creating this self-serving narrative and that the New York Times helped her with that. He also says that, this is a case where he's being villainized and being made to appear as if he engaged in impropriety when he didn't. He said, when you look at how she behaved during the filmmaking, that she engaged in a hostile takeover and tried to assert unilateral control over the movie and its contents and methods. He said this is the first of other, and they're going to be filing a bunch of lawsuits. They're going to be also releasing a lot of text messages. The Blake Lively camp actually just responded a few hours ago saying, this is not a he said, she said situation. His response in lawsuit, according to Blake Lively, is just to launch more attacks against her and engaging in victim shaming and blaming. Rich, this is getting really ugly really fast, and I don't think this is going anywhere anytime soon other than down an even more contentious path.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to everything you said, like one part of the story that's gaining a lot of attention that's interesting is it seems to you know, the New York Times story, it was titled, "We Can Bury Anyone," talks about the smear machine that allegedly was engaged to smear Blake Lively. There's a lot of text going back and forth where allegedly the PR campaign, you know, the PR company that was hired to smear her talks about their victory and so forth. That's kind of, you know, an interesting part of it. But, you know, my take on it is, at least on the Baldoni v. New York Times part of it, by the way, the New York Times said they vigorously stand by their story. They're going to oppose it. They're going to fight it. You know, it's part of this narrative that there's fake news, right? I mean, it all started with Trump calling news fake, and now you could attack, you know, an institution like the New York Times. I'm not saying the New York Times is right or wrong, but there's this culture now that anything that you don't agree with that's in the news, you could sue them. Anyone has the right to do that. But, you know, in the wake of Trump winning against ABC News that we covered last time and getting, what, $15 million from ABC News because George Stephanopoulos called Trump a rapist, there's this culture now that you could attack the news. And there's a large segment of the population that will buy that. So that's something I take out of it. But, Adam, what's your opinion on this story?
The most interesting thing I think that's come out of this story is some of the most recent stuff. Like, there's been fan theories on some of these like comic book pages about Ryan Reynolds putting jokes into Deadpool and Wolverine, referencing this story that the whole character of Nicepool is supposed to be Justin Baldoni. And then the response to that, like you were just saying, Rich, about the fake news, the attorney's going to use that Reddit page or whatever to threaten Ryan Reynolds with a lawsuit. For what? False light? I think that this is so off the rails, and it's the definition of a case that is more for publicity. I don't see how either party is even damaged here. I mean, can you imagine what damages you're going to claim, Rich, from this? They're both getting publicity. Back in the day, any publicity is good publicity. So what's the damage?
Well, yes, he got dropped by WME. I mean, obviously, this is going to have an effect on his career. So I think there's a claim for damages for sure. But, you know, whether it's valid or not, we're going to see.
There's a new 2025 buzzword in cities like New York and Chicago. Rich, talk to us about congestion pricing.
Well, I think I saw one study that Chicago is the fourth worst traffic city. Manhattan is the worst. New law going to effect beginning of the year puts congestion pricing in effect in Manhattan. I think it costs, what, $9 or something to come to the city at certain times. You know, proponents of that say it's going to make less cars come in because people don't want to pay, therefore less congestion, use public transport more. Opponents say it's going to hurt business. It's going to discourage people who want to come in and spend money in New York and business owners who have to come in because they have to bring their goods into New York. Of course, there was a lawsuit involved trying to put a hold on it. The judge in New York at the last minute said this law can proceed, this pricing can proceed. There's talk about appealing it. Interestingly, I just saw one news item that one of the major proponents of this, a woman who is described as a longtime rabble rouser, was just attacked in the subway in New York, was just beaten up by someone in New York. Ironic, because she's the one saying you should use more public transportation. Opponents of this law say, no, it's not safe to use public transportation in New York. Look at all these incidents of subway violence. That's why we have to drive. This woman who is a proponent of the subway system was beat up like a couple days ago. But, you know, Tina, I mean, the jury's out. There's lots of studies like in cities that have implemented this for a while, like London, that show it does have an effect. I personally, as someone who, you know, goes to New York a lot, I use public transportation all the time. It's pretty effective. It is incredibly difficult to drive around New York. Like a mile takes 45 minutes, literally. So anything that will reduce congestion, even by a little, I'm a big fan of.
I mean, I go to New York quite frequently, too, in Midtown, in the middle of the day. Midtown anytime is pretty nasty unless it's like 4 a.m. I agree, Rich. I mean, I take public transportation here. Sometimes when I'm traveling, I'm not so inclined to do it. And ultimately, I think, though, that when you have a measure like this, you kind of have to try it to see how it works out. But I just hope that there are mechanisms in place to try to keep people safe when you are trying to deflect people from using their cars and driving to public transportation, I do hope that they took measures, significant measures, to make the public transportation safer so that people stay safe during their transition.
Kevin, should you charge people to drive their car? People are, you know, people are serious about their driving and their cars. People love their cars. Should you charge people for it?
I have a real hard time with adding an extra tax. I look at it as more tax. You know, what happens, you know, when tolls go into place, when congestion, you know, pricing goes into place, things like that, that they don't go away. It's said to help with certain things, but people end up just, they end up just paying the tax. They end up paying the toll. They end up paying the price. And you're not going to really reduce too much. If they're going to drive in, they're going to drive in. They're doing it for a reason. The public transit in New York is amazing. You know, out here in Seattle, it's terrible. Now it's getting better, but people, the traffic's not even close to as bad. And they're trying to push for this and, you know, and they're tolling and all those things. So I don't know you're going to change behavior with the tax.
All right. Well, Quaker Oats is being sued over its Simply Granola product. Rich, you threw this one into the grab bag.
I mean, every couple of months, Tina, we're covering a story of a lawsuit by a consumer against a food product that they're alleging was fake. In this case, the plaintiffs are saying in a class action that Quaker Oats is unreasonably describing their granola as simple because it doesn't contain just simple products. It includes, if you look on the back of the box, they're saying products like vegetable oil, which is used as a binding agent, and inulin, which is a fiber. Basically, they're saying that this is false advertising, that they think they're buying a simple product that only includes granola, and there is much more to it. My question is, what the hell is granola anyway? I mean, who even knows what granola is? It's like, it's the food equivalent of potpourri. How are you going to allege that this is not simple granola when there's really no definition of granola, right? I mean, granola could be so many different things. Therefore, to sue this company because it's not, you know, just granola is kind of a circular argument. A dumb one.
I agree, Rich. I mean, granola is one of those amorphous concepts that none of us really know what it is. I think the term simply can be construed any number of ways. And number three, read the label. And if you are not one to read the label, then you really, I have no sympathy here at all. And I'm wondering to what extent, Rich, this is a byproduct of how people buy products these days, right? A lot of people buy them online, don't read labels anymore. And you know what? That's your fault if you don't read a label, if you're trying to be super nutritious.
Yeah. I mean, Tina's point is, Adam, like one that we talk about a lot, stop being stupid is the bottom line. You know, if you're stupid enough to think that, you know, food companies don't have more in their products than what is written on the front, then you're dumb and that's on you. If you think that cigarettes aren't harmful, you're dumb. If you think that driving isn't harmful, like, take some responsibility for yourself. Understand that, you know, these companies are in the business of selling products. They shouldn't do so fraudulently or deceitfully, but calling something simple and expecting there to be one ingredient is bananas.
Well, and I remember the phrase, I think it was Latin phrase from my law school days, caveat emptor, buyer beware. That's what we're talking about. Is we all know that advertisers are trying to literally sell us a bill of goods. So we should be skeptical when they tell us things, right? Simple may not be so simple. Read the label. You should be able to do that and make your decision accordingly. I think the court actually agreed with this too. Didn't they already dismiss this case and said it was frivolous? Absolutely. Just saying, yeah, there's nothing there. There's no there.
No, but I know already from your answers how you come down on this story, but why don't you tell us anyway?
I mean, good marketing, you know, right? Like, it just is a matter of, you can't blame a company for doing some good marketing, but, you know, does that beg the question? We need to have better, you know, oversight of our food in the U.S. Yeah, I think so. That's a whole different conversation, but it's not there yet. And so you can't hold them accountable for what is just plainly good marketing.
All right. Last one. A Florida lawyer allegedly smuggled drug-soaked documents into jail. Tina, You've got a Florida lawyer. We're used to a Florida man story, but this is a Florida lawyer story.
So this is one of those, I can't believe someone actually thought of this and thought this was a good idea. So Nathan Williams is the lawyer who decided to bring in legal documents soaked with a wild synthetic marijuana and into the Duval County Jail in Jacksonville in exchange for money and bribes. Apparently, there was a rash of dangerous overdoses as a result. There were 23 inmates who actually in February overdosed last year in this study. There are 21 people, including Williams. So I don't think we can accuse Nathan Williams, Rich, of being the only person who helped contribute to these overdoses. But apparently they were working, these folks were working with inmates and their family members to bring in these, drug-soaked documents. And apparently this probe into this activity was called Operation Stamp Collection. And once this probe began, Rich, the number of overdoses dropped by 61%. So, crazy stuff, but this guy was charged with 8 felonies as a result.
Yeah, I mean, zealous lawyering is one thing, but this is a different thing. But, you know, it kind of made me think, I didn't see it in the story, of how he was bringing the drugs in. I don't want to know, I think, the answer to that question, everyone, but we'll just leave that to our imagination. We'll wrap up with learning a little bit about our guests. We'll go around the room. Let's see. Adam mentioned Deadpool versus Wolverine in our Blake Lively story. Let's maybe talk about everyone's favorite superhero of all time, be it cinematic or otherwise. It seems like every superhero has been on the big screen, but who's your favorite superhero of all time? Kevin, we'll start with you.
Well, I got to go with what is an obvious one, being a dad and, Superman is the number one. Is you just try to be that for your kids. And so, all that Superman is and the good of Superman, although I'm looking forward to the new one coming out this summer. It looks a little bit darker of Superman. So
I don't know about that crypto. Though. I don't know about that crypto dog. They showed.
Yeah.
I didn't remember crypto from the comic. Looking like that, but anyway,
I did not love that part. That was a little cheesy for me. So we'll see. Adam,
you got a few. Let's get this out of the picture right away. Adam has been called the insurance world's version of Thor. We know that.
Well, so. to be clear, Fat Thor. But I don't mind it because Fat Thor is much more entertaining than regular Thor. I resemble that remark, so I'm good with it.
Besides Thor, who's your favorite?
Oh, you know, I'm a DC kind of guy, so it would really be that the trinity of Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. And if I had to pick one, I think the most interesting one is Batman. I remember the first big superhero movie when I was coming up was that Tim Burton Batman movie with the Prince soundtrack and Jack Nicholson and Michael Keaton, and I'd never seen anything like it. And I kind of became a comic book nerd as a result, so... that was my gateway into it. So I guess I got to go Batman.
Good one. Tina.
Loved Wonder Woman growing up. She was awesome. Linda Carter. She was fantastic.
You ever, maybe this was going to come out wrong, would you ever lasso David Sussler and make him tell the truth, much like Wonder Woman does?
I will just plead the fifth.
Ryan Burrow, favorites. Superhero Marvel.
I'll go outside of the box here with Mr. Incredible from The Incredibles.
Wow, it's a good one. Tatiana, Lisa, you guys got any? My favorite is Thing from the Fantastic Four. Ben Grimm. You know, I like a guy who's just made of rocks. He's similar to me in personality. But what about you guys, Lisa, Tatiana?
I like Black Widow.
Black Widow's a good one. Similar to Batman in that she doesn't have any inherent power. She just shoots people. Is that really a superhero that you shoot people dead?
It sure is. Yes, it is.
Well, Rich, in fairness, Batman's superpower is he's very rich.
Yeah.
Right. That's true.
He's got two superpowers. Love it.
All right. Thank you so much, damn CEO. Adam Bungie, and Kevin Swarin. And that'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face Off on WGN. Special thanks to Jennifer Jenkins, clinical professor at Duke University of Law at Duke University, Magna Legal Services Director of Jury Consulting, David Bernard, and Gabe Roth, Executive Director of Fix the Court, also WTTW correspondent Amanda Vinicki. Also, shouts out to Ben Anderson and Lisa Stiegel. For Tina Martini, Rich Lenkov, I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkov. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...